The third case for oral argument this morning is Southeast Properties Limited Partnership as the appellant versus the Advanced Recycling Systems, LLC, the appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Michael Schaefer, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Ronald Parsons, also an attorney from Sioux Falls. Justice Meyer Henry has disqualified herself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Mary P. Thorstenson, a circuit judge from the 7th Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Meyer Henry's place. Mr. Schaefer, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. It's my privilege to represent Southeast Properties in this case, and with me here today are Tom and Marv Luby, general partners of the company. This case raises an issue of first impression before this court. And the issue is whether the sale of an entire development triggers the right of first refusal held by a tenant to only a portion of the property. And following on that, the issue is whether the tenant can seek to enforce that right by a suit for money damages after the right expires. Secondly, this case illustrates why money damages as a remedy for a, quote, breach of a right of first refusal are inappropriate. In this case, the trial court concluded that there was a breach of the right of first refusal, then essentially permitted the case to proceed as a full-blown breach of contract for the sale of the property, and instead of the plaintiff being required to pay Southeast Property the value of the property to exercise the right, Southeast Property has been required by the award of a judgment of in excess of $460,000 to it.
Mr. Schaefer, what relief are you seeking? Are you saying you should win outright, or are you seeking another trial?
We're seeking order from this court directing that the circuit court be directed to dismiss the claim because there is no claim for breach of contract in this case. Now, at the outset, it's important to understand the property at issue. In 1995, Southeast Properties purchased what is known as 8th and Railroad Center. It's a contiguous piece of property between 8th and 10th Street in Sioux Falls, bordered on the west side by Reed Street and bordered on the south side by the 10th Street overpass. The property was purchased as one development, it was developed as one development, and it was sold as one development in July of 2004. There's some intimation, I mean, the property is comprised of different tracts, different lots, they've been assigned different addresses to different buildings within the development, but it's always been treated as one entire development. There's an insinuation on the part of Advance that somehow the property that's the subject of this lawsuit was thrown into this and bundled up as one parcel to defeat the right. And that's not what happened. This property has always been one development and been treated as such.
Was there conflicting evidence on that point at the trial?
No, there wasn't, Your Honor.
There was no allegation whatsoever that this was an end run.
This was
some kind of a end run to defeat
No. Marv Luby testified at trial that it was always treated as one development. There was no conflicting testimony on that issue. Now, what's important to understand here with respect to how this property is situated, the lease itself describes the premises in paragraph one. The premises consists of a 13,000 square foot block building, unheated, cement block building, many, like 50 some years old, that's situated on track 7, which is a triangular piece of property. Now, they didn't lease all of track 7. What they leased is the block building, 86 feet, I should say, north of that block building, and then 100 feet west of the block building on an adjoining track. All of these tracks are part of the single development. So that's what the premises are in this case. The right of first refusal in this case, at paragraph 29, is, and it's significant, and I think it's important. The right of first refusal says the tenant shall have the first right of refusal to purchase the premises which is the lease premises, in the event the landlord chooses to sell and produces a bona fide written offer to purchase. And then it goes on to say, tenant shall have 30 days to match the bona fide offer, and then an additional 30 days to close on the matched offer. In this case, there never was an offer for the leased premises. There was never an offer to match the entire property. The entire 8th and Railroad Center was sold as a whole. So the right of first refusal in this case was never triggered.
So you're saying the right of first refusal is to the entire property, not just the leasehold portion of it?
No, we're saying the right of first refusal is only to the leasehold property.
Okay.
But we're saying the offer to purchase the entire property, which encompassed this portion of it, did not trigger the right.
All right. Mr. Schaefer, as you indicate, as far as I can tell, this is a case of first impression, and cases around the country who have dealt with this, when you're fashioning a remedy, what do you do with the instance where someone would add an insignificant amount of property to avoid the right of first refusal?
There's a couple of decisions that have, where courts have looked at that, and there's a, they cite the Stamen case out of North Dakota and the Landis case, I think, out of Virginia, where court, where parties, in the Landis case, somebody threw in a 1.9 acres to the 17 acres that was unrelated to try to defeat it. That's not what we have here. It wasn't even owned by the estate. It was a separate property owned by someone else to try to defeat the right. That's not where we had, in the Stamen case, they tried to throw in personal property to try to defeat it. In the North Dakota Supreme Court, there was furthermore deceit in what the actual offer was. But what courts look at in a case like this, where there's, I mean, the courts have taken different positions. The Nevada Supreme Court has taken the position that says if there's a right on the whole, I mean, if there's an offer on the whole and the right is for a portion of that, the right isn't triggered when you have an offer on the whole. There's no right to claim a breach of contract. There can be no damages. What other courts have looked at in analyzing this is they look at what is the right at stake. The right of first refusal is not, first of all, what it is and what it isn't. It's an inchoate right. They refer to it as a preemptive right, a prerogative right, a dormant right, that doesn't entitle the holder to do anything until there's a receipt of a bona fide offer. At that point, the right is converted into or becomes an option. Once you have an option, you have an enforceable, now you have an offer, the principles of contract kick in, you have offer, acceptance, the right to assert a claim, potentially for breach of contract. But before you have that, you have an inchoate right that courts have, I mean, the Nevada court has said if it's not triggered, it's over. Other courts have taken the position and have said that what you do in a situation like this is you try to maintain the status quo. If there's an offer on the whole, the right on the parcel isn't triggered, but what you do is try to put the parties in the position to see what ultimately happens with that right. In other words, the courts say, we're going to enjoin the sale of the property, or if it's already been consummated, we're going to reconvey the property to see if the owner forms an intent ultimately to sell that specific parcel, or has an offer on the specific parcel, or until the right expires.
All right. Now, what's your position on that, because that seems to be inconsistent with what you were.
I think the position, I think you can do either adopt the Nevada position or adopt the position that I think the majority of courts have adopted, which is to say you maintain the status quo. To maintain the status quo, the remedy isn't a breach of contract claim. The remedy is an equitable claim that says you put the parties back in the position to see if an offer is ever made on that specific parcel or if the right expires.
Well, it's almost, maybe this is asking you to argue against yourself, but wouldn't the right of first refusal continue in the lease until the end of the lease?
It's exactly right, Your Honor. And the right, and that's what happened here. The right in this lease continued until September 30 of 2006. And the plaintiff was actually aware of this sale pretty shortly after. Yeah, it was actually in July of 2004, very shortly after the sale. They hired a lawyer in March of 2006 to write to Southeast Property to assert their claim that this was breached. They never did anything whatsoever. They let the lease expire, and they entered into a new lease with the new owner September 29 of 2006, where they got the rights to that premises, I think, until 2016. So the lease expired. When the lease expired, the right of first refusal expired, and it wasn't until January of 2007 that they brought this lawsuit. Now, every case that we've found and that we've cited says once the right expires, there's nothing that the court can do. The case should be dismissed.
Did they get a right of first refusal on the new lease?
No, they didn't.
Okay. So they did lose something.
Yes, but they lost it because they never took action to try to maintain the status quo.
But they also didn't get notice, did they? I mean, your client did not give notice that they were going to sell the property and that their inchoate right may be in jeopardy if the property sold.
That's correct, Your Honor. Our client didn't give notice. Our client never, in fact, as part of the problem here is Mr. O'Leary marked the deposition of Marv Luby and submitted it in support of the summary judgment motion, but it never became part of the record. So there's nothing in the record for you to look at on that. But the fact of the matter is there wasn't notice given because she viewed this as a sale of the whole. That's how she treated the property all along. You know,
But notice wasn't given, but yet there was knowledge.
There was knowledge. The sale was concluded July 15 of 2004. Within a week or two, they had notice that this had new ownership, that the new 8th and Railroad Center LLC was the new owner, and they dealt with those people. But they
You're saying they could have sought an injunction or some other equitable relief
yes.
at that time. They let their lease expire and their right expired with it.
They should have sought a reconveyance is what they should have done to see if they could have preserved the right until the end of the lease. They never did that. That's the remedy that the courts have fashioned. The reason the courts do this is, quite frankly, because an intent to sell the whole parcel does not supply the intent to sell the specific parcel. The courts are unanimous in that. You can't infer the intent to sell the individual parcel from the intent to sell the whole. And the courts can't actually reach in and supply that intent, and they can't supply the terms, and they can't really create a contract for the parties. So the only available remedies here to protect a right which isn't a full-blown contract right is equitable relief. And our maxims of, you know, you're entitled to equitable relief where there's no adequate remedy at law apply here because there is no ability to even develop a breach of contract claim because you can't have offer and acceptance until there's some kind of an offer made in the property. So that's what happened here is that they essentially abandoned the only remedy that they had, let it lapse, and then brought a lawsuit to try to claim breach of contract damages. That's essentially what we have in this case. But I think the majority of courts say that to protect the right, you have to have an injunction or a reconveyance until the lease expires. But they've not contradicted the cases that we found that says once the right expires, the court can do nothing to enforce it.
You know, reconveyance is kind of a tall mountain, especially when third parties have become involved. And I think Appley pointed out in their brief that when third parties are involved, sometimes you can't undo some. So you can't grant equitable relief.
Well, except that all of the courts that have looked at this have said that you can require reconveyance. A reconveyance could have been required. You know, and what would happen at that point, who knows? Parties might get together and figure out that they need to try to work something out to resolve it. But that never happened here. I mean, what they've tried to do here is to essentially conflate the right of first refusal into a full-blown breach of contract to sell. That gives them damages that are far and beyond anything that could have been anticipated. Because now we've got a situation, and the case that the court relied on is, and it's the Kansas case, Anderson versus Armor, you know, it says the right was breached because they didn't give notice. Well, I reread the Anderson case this morning, and in Anderson, that was a cattle feeder leased some property near a packing plant. The packing plant ultimately sold the whole property to another packing plant, and he brought a lawsuit against the seller. But in that case, the specific language of the lease provided, it says, in the event the lessor desires to sell the premises, the lessor agrees to notify the lessee in writing of such intention and of the purchase price and shall allow lessee 15 days from day of mailing such notice within which to attempt to negotiate a purchase and sale contract for the premises with the lessor. It's not even a match. It says if we get notice, you have to give us notice of your intent to sell and then we'll try to work something out. The Kansas court says that notice provision was breached. And we don't have a notice provision here. And what we have here is a very straightforward right of first refusal that says if there's a bona fide offer to purchase the lease premises, if the landlord chooses to sell the lease premises, the tenant has a right to match that bona fide offer. That's not what happened in that Kansas case. Furthermore, in that case, the damages that were awarded were the leasehold improvements that the tenant had made to the property. They weren't entitled to full-blown breach. They were entitled to the damages for the value of the leasehold improvements that they'd put into that feedlot. In this case, it looked like that's the way it was going to go because they initially hired an appraiser, Mr. Shackett, to put a value on the property, and then he included in his appraisal about $70,000 worth of relocating expenses for scales and other equipment. And then he included a provision that said there's $214,000 additional damages because I'm projecting out over a 10-year period, if they would have held this for 10 years at a 5.7% rate of appreciation, it would have resulted in an additional $214,000, which was never reduced to present value.
Can I go back to the notice thing? Yeah. I realize it's part of the record missing, but you said there's no notice provision here, but isn't notice implied here? I mean, how would they know that there was an offer unless they gave them notice of it?
I don't know that it is, Your Honor. In that Crow Speaker case, which was a case, the Nevada case, it was a sale of the whole, and then somebody came in later, and I don't think they had any notice. And the court just said the right was not triggered because there was no intent to sell the smaller portion. The key is was there an intent to sell the smaller portion? Here there was not. The court can't supply that intent. All the court can do is to maintain the status quo to see if that ever comes to fruition during the term of the right.
There has to be something the courts can do to protect those inchoate rights so that the landlord, I mean, the landlord has to keep his or her bargain here. So there has to be some remedy for that person who has this right of refusal.
And that remedy, Your Honor, is the remedy to enjoin the sale or to have a reconveyance to leave that status quo in place until the lease and the right expires. That's what the remedy that the majority of the courts have found. Now, there's no way, there's a couple courts that have come up with a theory that we're going to give specific performance. There's a case out of North Dakota where they sold like 390 acres of farm ground and there was a 4-acre parcel that had a tower on it and they just took the same value for everything and said that's the value, the per acre value is what we assign. There's a case involving a condominium where they just took the square footage and assigned it because there was an actual amount. There's no amount here because there was no apportionment of any of the purchase price to any specific portions of the 8th and Railroad Center. So you can't resort to that.
You know, we're going to have to adopt a rule that's going to apply to all cases. And is the remedy going to be adequate, the remedy you propose, in the case where the lessee never gets notice and wanted to purchase the property, never gets notice until the lease is expired?
I'm not sure I've even seen a case like that, Your Honor. You know, that raises an interesting question, but that's not this case. I mean, all you can look, and I know what you're trying to say, but all we have here is we know that the tenant had notice in July of 2004, within a week or two after the sale. We know they hired a lawyer in March of 2006, about six months before the right expired. They didn't do anything. They waited until after the right had expired to bring the claim.
So if I hear you correctly, in answer to Justice Inner's question, you're saying rather than a bright-line rule, we should let it up to the discretion of the trial court based on the facts of the specific case before that judge.
Well, I think,
as far as the remedy.
I guess I haven't really thought that far, but I think in terms of the issue, with the facts presented here, the remedy of reconveyance was a viable remedy.
I understand you just want to win your case, but we're trying to set a rule for the future.
And I don't know what the remedy would be because, quite frankly, I haven't seen a case where the right had expired before they learned of the sale. I've never seen that case. I don't know. And maybe in the commercial world it's unrealistic to expect, but, you know, I suppose if it was a short time frame between when the right expired and when the sale occurred, it could happen. But most people would know who their new landlord is.
Your time's expired.
Thank you,
Mr. Schaefer. Mr. Parsons, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Mr. Schaefer. Every breach of contract case involving different contract language is a case of first impression in this court. Cookie-cutter rules don't always work because this case depends on the language of this lease. And it comes down really, as I think the court has demonstrated, to one simple question, the entire case. The lease between Southeast Properties and Advanced Recycling contained a contractual right of first refusal to purchase the leased premises that were described in the lease, specifically. Did Southeast violate or breach that contractual right of first refusal when it sold the leased premises along with other property to someone else without ever giving them the opportunity to exercise their contractual rights?
Is there a difference between violate and breach?
No, I don't think so. Not under South Dakota law. South Dakota law says if you break, violate an enforceable promise, that's a breach of contract if it results in damages. If the sale violated the provision, then it's a breach of contract. And all of their other arguments collapse about triggers and waivers. They all collapse because once a contract is breached, you can bring an action for breach of contract. And you're entitled to all contractual remedies as appropriate under the law. So to figure out if a breach of contract occurred, you have to look at the language of this lease, which their brief doesn't really get into because they want to apply these broad rules that aren't necessarily applicable to this situation and which are very conflicted. The law is all over the place, all over the country on these issues. Under South Dakota law, to figure out if a breach occurred, you look at the intent of the parties as expressed in the language of the agreement. You use the plain and ordinary meaning of those terms. And if it's ambiguous, you construe it against the drafter. And you can look to extrinsic evidence if it's ambiguous. But it's still a question of law.
Mr. Parsons, going to the right of first refusal, the language is refusal to purchase the premises in the event the landlord chooses to sell and produces a written bona fide offer to purchase. In this case, Mr. Schaefer is saying there isn't any offer on the specific premises.
Yeah, they're trying to add language to the contract. Look at the language. It says the tenant shall have the right of first refusal to purchase the premises, we know what they are, in the event the landlord chooses to sell and produces a written bona fide offer to purchase. Was there a written bona fide offer to purchase these premises? Trial Exhibit 2.
So Mr. Parsons, if I've read correctly, it was indicated that the parties said that they could not match that offer because they weren't interested in the whole development. They just wanted their portion.
I would disagree with that because they didn't have the right to purchase the entire property. They had the right to purchase the leased premises. There was a written offer to purchase the leased premises. The leased premises, it's Exhibit 2, it says this is an offer to purchase, and it includes the leased premises along with these two other properties.
So you're saying that if Southeast had the offer for the entire development, at that point in time, Advanced could come in and say, I want to buy just my premises, and they would have to then sell to Advanced?
If they would either just choose not to sell or sell to Advance, because Advance has the contractual right to purchase those premises.
But the language in the option, or in the right of first refusal, says have the right to match. What would they match?
They would match the offer presented. Now,
there isn't an offer.
Well, there is an offer to there's a price of $5.3 million for these three properties. Now, yeah, you would have to figure out what is the value of the leased premises. Now, otherwise, then you could always defeat this provision by just bundling it with something else and just having one big price. Obviously, the leased premises has a value, and that would have to be determined. And that's why you have to give them notice so they can come in and seek an injunction before this occurs.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. But the idea here, at least what we've heard, was that this was one development, purchased as a development, sold as a development, different from the North Dakota case that said we'll attach a little piece of land and now we'll sell it and kind of circumvent the right of first refusal.
But that's from the perspective entirely of the defendant. These are different pieces of property that have been patched together over the years. Different buildings built at different times for different purposes. It was purchased as one, you know, these different tracts of land were purchased together, but they weren't. This wasn't like we're buying Disney World. We're buying this property with these different buildings, different plats. They owned all of it. Well, that was really the only relationship that these buildings have to each other. And they intended eventually, when this right of first refusal was put into the contract, to develop it as a single property. Here's what the undisputed evidence is about the negotiations. Advanced Recycling said, we'll lease this property, which is like an empty warehouse that's across a parking lot from what eventually became the 8th and Railroad Center, and down the block is what eventually became the DeWitt Design Building. 1995, Advanced Recycling wants to set up a long-term business for their recycling business, and they say, we'll move in here, but only if you give us a contractual right of first refusal, so if this property that we're leasing is ever sold, we have the first dibs on it. The Southeast said, no, we won't do that. We refuse to put that in because eventually we would like to develop this all as one property, as an investment. None of that had occurred yet, but that was their future plans. The parties talked about this. Undisputed record is Advanced Recycling said, well, then we won't become your tenant. That's a deal breaker. And Southeast Property said, okay, we give in. We want you as a tenant. We'll put in the contractual right of first refusal. 10 years later, they get a letter in the mail that says, hi, we're the new owners. We just bought your premises. Start sending your lease payments to us. They were flabbergasted. They didn't know what to do. I mean, these are, common small business owners. They tried to find a lawyer but most of the lawyers in town said, we won't go up against these people because there's so many conflicts of interest in this case. But eventually, they did find a lawyer. And they did so well within the time period for bringing a breach of contract claim, well within the time period.
What about the expiration, though, of the lease and the right in the lease?
It's irrelevant. The Abdallah versus Abdallah case by the United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit explains that very well. It's irrelevant. That's only applicable if you hold there was not a contract breach. And that's applicable if you hold that they didn't breach the contract by selling the leased premises in this case. If there was a contract breach, they had the right to bring a breach of contract action. Whether the right of first refusal continued after that is irrelevant. It's only relevant in those cases where courts say you don't breach a right of first refusal by bundling property together or selling more property than is covered by the right of first refusal.
Mr. Parsons, what about the situation where, in this case, the time expired on the lease, they renegotiated a new lease? What's to prevent any person who's leasing, who's unhappy with the new conditions of their lease, to come back and say, my rights were violated and I'm entitled to monetary damages?
They have every right to do that if there was a breach of contract. Yes. But that's not this case either, because here there was ownership passed. Their lease with Southeast expired the moment the sale occurred. Now their lease is with a different party, with Eric Abelian,
who purchased the property. Wait a minute. Didn't their lease continue?
The lease continued, but it's a different party. They have a different contractual relationship.
But the lease continued with the same term, and they continued to have a right of first refusal in that lease until it...
Exactly, but by that point, the right of first refusal was already breached. You already have a broken contract, and that gives you the right to bring a claim against someone who is now not a party to your lease, the one who used to be the party to the lease, Southeast.
But the claim wasn't brought until January, after a new lease had been negotiated with that new person.
But that's not relevant to the breach of contract claim, because the breach of contract claim is against... Southeast. Southeast breached the contract by not offering this property, the leased property, to be sold to my clients. When they did that, the property was sold to somebody else. That breached their contract, and their remedy is against Southeast. Whether their lease continued or the right of first refusal continued with a third party is irrelevant. The only reason this comes up are those cases where courts hold that you don't breach a contract by bundling property together and selling it to a third party. That's the only way this issue comes up. Otherwise, it's truly irrelevant, and that's why, you know, it's not something that was even part of the evidence really in this case or argued, because
argued before the trial court now that this was a bundling deliberately done in order to circumvent it.
No, I think they forgot about it. I think these are honest people who forgot what their contract said, but now they're asking this court to put terms in the contract that aren't there. I mean, it's interesting. You don't have evidence, there's no affidavit or testimony in this case that says, from Southeast, that says, we intended to still be able to sell the leased premises if we sold it with other property. They didn't say that. They didn't say that because it's not true. And they're honest. You know, breach of contract doesn't depend on bad faith. It depends on if you breach a contractual right. And it's legal damages. We're not asking for punitive damages. We're not arguing for intent. The contract language says, if you sell these premises, the leased premises, to somebody else without giving us the offer to buy them, then that's a breach of contract.
All right. Mr. Parsons, let's get to the issue of damages. How did the court determine, what did it use as a measure of damages? Because it took evidence and came up, rewrote it, came up with a value, and then it came up with a term of years. What's the measure of damages that it reached point?
That was really, the trial was about damages, and we had, you know, two experts. We had a real estate appraiser, and we had an expert economist. And essentially, they said what was reasonable. This was purchased by the Southeast as an investment property, and that same benefit would have accrued to my client if they'd been allowed to purchase the leased premises. So a value of $290,000 was placed on this property using two different approaches. They chose the lower approach. They testified. There was expert testimony that provided different alternatives, assuming like a 10-year holding period and a 15-year holding period. And then eventually they would have sold the property. And it took into account all the costs that they would have had to have incurred in holding it, the taxes and so forth, reduced it to present value and arrived at a number. So there's the whole trial and the whole transcript is filled with expert testimony supporting this valuation and the damages.
Is there any obligation to cover, to look for other property, or can they just hold it out and go 15 years?
It's a fact question, but they mitigated their damages by continuing to lease the property. Otherwise, they would have had to pick up and buy a new building and renovate it again like they did this property, refit it to their business. So they mitigated their damages by signing a new lease. But all of our fact questions, it's abuse of discretion, and they've only appealed on two little factual quarrels about the damages. But they're all certainly within the trial court's abuse of discretion, its discretion. Judge Caldwell was the jury in this case, the finder of fact. The real question is, that really covers everything, is do you breach this right of first refusal when you sell the leased premises with other property? Is that a breach of contract? If it's not, then there is no case.
Mr. Parsons, do you distinguish between the North Dakota case that attached the little piece of property versus someone who comes in and says, it's a development, I want to sell it as a development?
Well, no, because I go by the contract language. I think that's what has to govern it.
But I mean, I don't know in this case, but I mean, generally speaking, one versus the other, do you see a difference, or is there, if you have a right of first refusal, you have a right of first refusal?
Yeah, I think if you have contract rights, you have contract rights. The bad intent of the other party is not relevant. I mean, the crux of the question is, under this contract language, can you sell the leased premises by combining it with other property and putting one price tag on it? Can you defeat a party's contract rights by doing that? Now, if this court agrees with Judge Caldwell and says, no, you can't do that, here's what will happen. Landlords will know that if they have a right of first refusal, and they want to defeat it by bundling it with other property or selling it in a larger piece, they'll know, I better put that in the contract. And tenants will know that if that language is in there, you have a right to lease the premises, but we can defeat that right by selling the premises with other property. If that's in there, tenants will know that, and tenants to whom a right of first refusal is critically important, as it was to my clients, won't sign that contract. The evidence in this case is they wouldn't have signed the contract. They would not have agreed to a right of first refusal that allowed it to be defeated simply by combining the leased premises with any other property.
Except if
we would never have agreed to that.
If we go that direction, tenants would also know that they have a right to get an injunction to stop the sale.
Well, that's right, and that goes to the remedy. Here, they couldn't get an injunction to stop it because they didn't know about it till after the fact. They, by the time they got a lawyer, which was well within the time for them to file a breach of contract action, the other person had, the third party, the innocent third party, had organized its business around this property. And that's what Judge Caldwell looked at in particular.
But the cases adopting that rule also allow the equitable remedy of setting aside the sale.
They allow it. That's true. And in some circumstances, that might be the appropriate remedy. The Lamar advertising case is a primer on contract remedies just issued by this court in 2008. It involved a very analogous situation in terms of remedies. Their advertising business had real property rights to put up billboards. There was a contract with the plaintiff that said, he purchased the billboard, and the contract said you can't put any other billboards within 1,000 feet. The advertising company breached that. It had at least two signs within 1,000 feet. They brought a breach of contract action. The trial court awarded contract damages. The plaintiff said, wait a minute, I don't agree with the remedy that the trial court gave the plaintiff for my breach of contract. I think you should have granted a specific performance remedy. And this court said, well, first of all, the remedy that the trial court gives is abuse of discretion because it depends on the particular factual circumstances of this case. And in that case, it would be unfair to grant that type of remedy because these innocent third-party billboard owners would be injured. And so considering all the circumstances, a money damages remedy was considered the appropriate remedy. And this court also underlined that an essential element to granting an equitable remedy is the lack of an adequate remedy at law. And because that party had a perfectly adequate remedy at law in the form of damages, that was not an abuse of discretion, certainly, to grant a legal remedy. Same thing in this case. There's a perfectly adequate remedy in the form of contract damages. Trial court did not abuse its discretion in granting contract damages for a breach of contract. But again, it depends on your interpretation of the contract. Was there a breach or not? Do you breach a contract by selling leased premises with other property when it says my clients should have had the first right to purchase the leased premises? The only way that you can interpret the contract the way they want you to is by adding language to it.
Or adopting this inchoate right theory.
Well, or adopting a broad theory that might not apply to this contract language. I mean, I understand the inchoate right theory, and I agree to it to the extent that the right's not triggered until an offer is made on the lease premises. But an offer was made to purchase these premises. It just included other property, too. And so the courts that recognize that that violates this type of provision, most of them say the remedy depends on the circumstances. The reason that a lot of these turn out to be specific performance cases is because that's what the plaintiff asked for, and they didn't ask for a contract remedy, or because they had advance notice and brought the action before the sale occurred, you know, so they could try to stop it. That's what should have happened in this case.
Do I recall that that your client voluntarily gave up their claim for equitable relief?
They did, yes. Yeah, they brought a claim for legal breach of contract damages.
And they gave that up for some reason.
Yeah, because they elected their remedy, a breach of contract remedy. Yes, absolutely. I cited in the brief the American Family versus Auto Owners case, and it reminds me a little bit of that situation because there, you know, that involved a lease, and it was the trial court kind of applied a broad rule that said tenants are always considered co-insureds of their landlord's property insurance policies, just adopting a general cookie-cutter rule. And this court reversed, and it said, no, actually what we have to do is look at the contract in this case, and in determining what a remedy is, we have to look at the factual circumstances of this case. And it rejected a kind of a broad rule, and instead it said, let's go back to the language in the contract. As understood, common sense, it's common terms, it's common meanings. If someone says you have the right to purchase these premises, you have the first right, and if we get an offer to buy them, we'll allow you the right to match it. And then they sell the premises by adding other property along with it. Doesn't that violate your rights? I mean, isn't that a breach of contract under the plain and ordinary meaning? And if the person who wrote the contract, Southeast, wants to add an exception there saying, well, but that only applies if we sell just the leased premises, not if we add other property. Shouldn't they put that in the contract? I mean, isn't that what South Dakota contract law is?
Your time has expired, Mr. Parsons. Thank you. Mr. Schaefer, you have 10 minutes, sir.
In response to the last comment by Mr. Parsons, that's exactly what was put into the contract. The contract with the right of first refusal gave a right of first refusal to the premises, which were the leased premises. And it provided that if the landlord chooses to sell and produces a written bona fide offer to purchase, the tenant has a right to match that bona fide offer. That never happened here. We adhered to this contract. This contract included the precise language that they claim that should have been there. The problem is there was never an attempt to sell this one individual parcel. There was only an intent and an attempt to sell the whole thing. So this right was never breached. It was never triggered. And what Mr. Parsons is attempting to do, and what he was successful with the trial court, or Mr. O'Leary was, is to say that if there is a violation of this right in some fashion, that constitutes a full-blown breach of contract to sell the property. It's conflated. He takes an inchoate right and conflates it into a full-blown breach of contract to sell. And I respectfully disagree with his recitation of what the Third Circuit held in the Abdallah case, because the Abdallah case had a right of first refusal. There was actually an offer made that triggered the right, and the owner or the landlord never communicated that to the tenant. The court permitted the tenant because now we had an offer. Now we had an option, according to the Third Circuit, which gave right to breach of contract damages. We don't have that here. Here, there is no offer to match that provides, that triggers this or ripens it into an option. It's still an inchoate right that, as the majority of courts said, is entitled to some protection, but that protection is in the form of equitable relief because there is no adequate remedy at law because it doesn't amount to a breach of contract yet. So the equitable relief is to give them an injunction or provide a reconveyance so that the property is then put back at the status quo ante and to see if anything triggers that actual right, ripens it into an option before the lease expires. Here they simply, they put all their marbles, all their chips on black, said we're going to abandon our claim for specific performance, we're going to not seek any of the equitable relief, we're going to just go for money damages and try and convert this claim, this inchoate right, into a full-blown breach of contract.
So Southwest's position is that this offer on the entire property shouldn't have been given to Advanced in any way to see if they could purchase it.
Exactly.
They weren't required to any notice.
We weren't required. But if the court deems that there should have been some requirement and that in what the cases say is that the right can't be defeated by, and these are all the cases, Your Honor, that deal with the sale of a whole where there's a right on a parcel within it. All of those cases. And we're not here talking about trying to throw something in that didn't belong there. We're talking about the whole property where there's a right on a small portion of it. Those courts say you can't defeat the right in that fashion. But the remedy is limited to the injunction or reconveyance to see if the right is triggered or if it expires. That's the limited remedy that you have for this limited right. And it's commensurate, the remedy is commensurate with the right that's at stake. On the question of damages, Your Honor, what happened here is there was originally an attempt, I think, to try to recover the kind of damages that were recovered in the Anderson case for the relocation of the equipment. They actually proved it up at trial. And then in the middle of trial, they abandon it. They says, we're dismissing it. We're not seeking to recover that. Because what we did is we produced a report from Mr. Cashmitter, who said there aren't any damages as a result of, even if this is construed as a breach of this right of first refusal. Because they, as Mr. Shackett said, you know, there's this appreciation in the value of the property. Mr. Cashmitter said that's assumed when you buy property. It's included within the purchase price. And at trial, we finally got Mr. Shackett to agree to that. So then what they did is they had Mr. Frankenstein testify as a so-called rebuttal witness to Mr. Cashmitter to say, well, we're going to parlay this. I'm going to take the ownership cost, except he didn't include all the costs of ownership like taxes, repair, maintenance, and everything, and the cost of rent, and we're going to figure out what the difference is, and we're going to parlay an appreciation factor of 5.7% over a period of 15 years, and that's going to be what they're entitled to. And that's the number, somewhat the number that they came up with. The problem is the building, which represented $195,000 of the $290,000 value, both real estate experts agreed was a depreciating asset. It had 5 to 10 years of remaining life. It was depreciating. It needed all this work. And yet Mr. Frankenfeld parlayed that at a 5.7% rate of appreciation into the future, not recognizing the reality of what we were dealing with. The other problem I have with the damage award is that what Mr. O'Leary submitted to the trial court for findings of fact and conclusions of law as to what the damages were can't be found in the record. They're not in the exhibit of Mr. Frankenfeld. They can't be found in any of the testimony. The numbers are look like they're made up. They're close to what Mr. Frankenfeld's base case is, but they're nowhere in the record. There's no support in the record for the numbers that the court just adopted in his proposed findings. I think the court understands the issue, and this is not a full-blown breach of contract to sell the property, which is what Mr. Parsons would have the court believe. This is a limited right that we submit was never triggered, never ripened, never came to fruition as a result of the offer. And even if it did, the only, and even if there was some limited remedy that they were entitled to, it was a remedy to maintain the status quo, which they abandoned, which no longer exists, and once the right expires, they have no remedy in court. The cases, they still have not come up with a decision. We've cited the Johnny Pelham's case and the Myers case out of Iowa, where both courts that addressed that specific issue said if the right expires, the court, all it can do is dismiss the case because there's nothing to enforce. And they've not come up with any contrary authority to that in all of the authorities that have been submitted to the trial court or this court. So for those reasons, we respectfully request that the court remand this case with directions that it be dismissed.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.